Listen, learn, and enjoy.
It's the Lisa Show.
With Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. The Lisa Show is happening now.
Have you noticed the rapid increase in foreign media making itself present in America? Coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to talk about one of the most astounding cases of this, Demon Slayer Infinity Train.
Angelica, bay leaf, basil, black cumin, brown mustard, catnip, cayenne pepper, chicory, chili pepper.
Is this your grocery list?
No, it's what we're talking about coming up in your morning buzz.
As parents, we do anything to protect our kids from danger and from harm. You know, we make sure that they don't fall down the stairs or touch a hot stove or swim without supervision. But as they get older, the dangers that they face are harder to spot. I know that this creates a lot of anxiety in parents, right, of knowing not, you know, your desire to help them and to keep them safe doesn't increase. You know, decrease by any means. In fact, it probably increases. It's just harder to do that. More than half of the U.S. population will be diagnosed with a mental illness at some point in their lifetimes. And these mental health issues come in all shapes and sizes, from depression to anxiety. And as our kids become adults, right, as they start to grow and develop, we might be mistaking their teenage angst for something actually more serious. So, I mean, the question remains, how can we know if our growing children need professional health for their mental health?
Yep.
You know, how do you know what's typical and what requires extra help?
Yeah, you don't want to be the overreactionary parent, but you don't want to be the underreactionary either.
Exactly. So we know that this is on a lot of our minds. So we've invited into our conversation today about signs that maybe our young adult needs a little bit of help, David McFarlane and Jennifer Dobelful Quinlan. They're the co-founders of Hope Recovery and Healing. Thank you, David and Jennifer, for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Is mental health...
Glad to join you.
We're so glad that you're here. Is mental health more of an issue for today's young adults than it was for past generations? Let's start with you, Jennifer.
It actually is. So, interestingly, there are several studies in the last even 5 years that have underscored how much mental health issues are increasing, notably among adolescents and then also among those in the, we call it early adulthood or emerging adulthood, in the 18 to 30-year-old range. In fact, in the last decade, major depression has increased over 52% in adolescents.
Wow.
And 63% in the emerging adult age range. So pretty significant.
Wow. If I understand those statistics correctly, you're saying that most adolescents and emerging adults have serious depression.
Yeah. In fact, 40% of young adults have a diagnosable disorder. So if you have two children, the odds are one of them has something going on that needs some professional, potentially.
So when we talk about diagnosable, for you, David, what does this mean? What does diagnosable mean? I feel like that statistic is so high that I need to know more around it.
So diagnosable means that it meets the criteria for the official manual, the DSM-5, that gets used in the psychology world to assess where a person is, what their symptoms are, and whether those are really interfering with life to the point where this is a disorder, not just a season or a small issue in somebody's life. So there are criteria for depression. There are criteria for anxiety. Mm-hmm. There are criteria for PTSD and a wide range of these issues. And typically what makes it diagnosable is that this is persistent and pervasive, and it's affecting your ability to function. It's affecting the way you feel, not just for a day or a week, but as your normal. When it gets to that level, this is what we mean by a diagnosable disorder.
So this is the big question, and maybe we're not going to be able to, well, I guess just scratch the surface, but certainly there are many conversations in homes all across America asking that this question, what is the driving this increase in mental health issues for young adults? Jennifer, what's your perspective?
Well, I'm actually going to toss that to David because he's done some research on this and has talked about it. But I can say there are a lot of people publishing books about this and a lot of theories of what can contribute to it. Mm-hmm. But Dave, why don't you dig in on that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, and a lot of other people have talked about this.
Sure.
And so I'm going to add my voice to what's happened. The experience of the current rising generation and the millennials who kind of came before them is unlike the experience that any previous generation has had because of the immersive technology environment that they grew up in and developed in. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's happened at the same time that this generation has grown up and been exposed to constant access to the internet and smartphones and social media is that we've also developed a lot more understanding in the field about trauma and what trauma is and what it does to the nervous system, to the brain, to the body. And there is a connection between these two things. The experience that our young people have had growing up has been far more traumatic because of their connection to all of these technological marvels, which, you know, have a lot of good that they bring as well. It has created a traumatic experience for them. And I'd love to dive into some of the reasons for that. And again, our conversation might not be long enough to spend much time on it as we would need to.
But being able to highlight some of these things, and when we hear trauma, like that seems that seems like the, to this nth level, like maybe more than we would suspect. Like, you know, we sort of engage and go, oh, yeah, there's too much time, or maybe they were bullied a little bit on online or those kind of things. But when we say trauma, that seems like we're taking it up another level. How is trauma experienced for this age group?
Especially in a way we might not have previously considered.
Yes. And I think that's the key, is that we really don't think of their experience as traumatic because we typically associate trauma with combat violence or a major disaster or something that's more obvious. But our bodies and our brains respond to the things around us with survival instincts all the time. And when those become the normal, that is what creates a traumatic experience. So for here's some ingredients of trauma that certainly have been present for our young adults. Feeling a sense of separation or isolation, feeling stuck or trapped and unable to get out of a situation, having not just your physical body threatened, but your general sense of security or safety or identity threatened. When these kinds of things combine, it creates a trauma response. And so a lot of our young adults and adolescents are dealing with post-traumatic stress symptoms. And that's part of why this is so puzzling and frustrating. And that's part of why it's this huge wave of increase that's happened, is because there has been a traumatic generational experience. And now they're dealing with the symptoms, but we're not really looking through a lens of trauma all the time. And we're just kind of scratching our heads saying, well, why would this generation be so depressed or anxious or whatever compared to other generations? They are dealing with the effects of, for example, how would making mistakes, okay? One of the key characteristics of Generation Z in particular is the risk aversion, a fear of taking risks. Well, where does that come from? If I know that any mistake I make is subject to public exposure on the internet and through social media, you better believe I'm not going to want to take risks. You better believe that I'm going to feel totally self-conscious and hyper-vigilant about every step I take all along the way. So the risk of the public exposure of a mistake that I make as an adolescent today compared to 30 years ago is almost unimaginable for those of us who have not had that experience.
Well, we
in our teenage years.
Appreciate having David McFarlane and Jennifer Doblefull Quinlan talking to us from the co-founders of Hope Recovery and Healing about this situation. And I appreciate you laying out the reasons why we're seeing such a huge increase in mental health issues for our adolescents and young adults, and laying out those reasons, because it gives us, I think, some compassion and some context. I'd love to now to change the direction of the conversation to the what can we do kind of portion of this conversation. Specifically, how can parents identify when one of their adolescents or young adults needs help in either major or in subtle ways that we might miss?
You know, we talk about that a lot, of course, at Hope Recovery and Healing, because not only are we providing treatment for those who suffer from this, various disorders, but we're also trying to provide support for the loved ones in their lives. And so we draw a lot also on the National Alliance for Mental Illness, also known as NAMI. And they kind of came up with these 10 signs. So some of these might seem obvious, and some of them might be like, well, how do I know if that's really serious?
Mm-hmm.
Let me just pop through those quickly.
Yeah, that'd be great.
We can talk about it. Okay. So the top 10, which maybe it's the bottom 10.
Yeah.
Feeling sad or withdrawn for more than a couple of weeks. Seriously trying to harm or kill oneself or making plans to do so. Severe out of control risk-taking behaviors. So not just like, kind of being impulsive, but severe risk-taking behaviors. Sudden overwhelming fear for what appears to be no reason. It seems unjustified or irrational. Significant changes in eating and weight. So, for example, not eating or eating a lot more than they used to, maybe throwing up or using laxatives. And then that might, be tied to then significant weight loss, more than like 10 or 20 pounds or gain also. Seeing, hearing, or believing things that are not real. And this can be a little bit interesting because people who have a religious background might have a sense of like ancestors speaking to them or, spirits or things from beyond or whatever. We're not talking about that. We're talking about seeing something or hearing or believing something that is not centered in reality or in a religious or a theological context, okay? Repeatedly using drugs or alcohol. Now, we know like marijuana use is pretty common among emerging adults now, but if it's like multiple times a day or more than daily, there's maybe that those tools are being used as an escape from something that's painful or difficult to cope with. Number 8, drastic changes in mood, behavior, personality, and we also roll into that sleeping habits. So we also know adolescents and young adults kind of have erratic sleep habits, but if it becomes something like sleeping 18 hours a day or not sleeping for 3 days in a row or something like that, and then obviously mood, behavior, personality, all of those things can be thrown into the mix when sleeping gets off. But likewise, mood, behavior, and personality can really impact sleeping habits too. Extreme difficulty concentrating or even just staying still. So maybe they're really fidgety and they didn't used to be. And of course, we might immediately equate that with ADHD, which is a diagnosable disorder. And sometimes we're kind of quick to dismiss that as normal or as ADHD is no big deal. But in fact, that attention deficit and hyperactivity can stem into or can lead into other dysfunctions as well. And so it's important to identify it and treat it and not just ignore it or brush it under the rug or whatever. And then finally, number 10. Intense worries or fears that get in the way of daily activities. So, this was really prevalent. This is maybe the most cited sign that people are starting to have issues with the onset of COVID. People had intense, really, really intense anxieties and fears that actually prohibited them from getting groceries, and therefore they stopped eating, or prohibited them from talking to anyone, even on the phone, because these fears just went like to the nth degree. So these are just 10 things, but overall, a parent should just watch for changes that last more than more than several days. And the best way for a parent to know is to just talk. Hey, how are you doing? Hey, seem kind of quiet today. Mm-hmm. Doing okay? Not like, hey, seems like you're depressed. Parents don't need to diagnose. They just need to be there and ask, what's going on? How are you doing? You seem a little anxious or a little stressed. I'm not sure if you're doing okay, and I just wondered if there's anything you want to talk about, that kind of stuff.
Organizations like Hope Recovery and Healing, organizations that are focused mm-hmm. on helping with trauma for our youth, I would be curious, is it in combination with the discussions that we're having within our home? Is it paired up with individual therapy? Is it like how
is it best?
How do people engage? Yeah, how do people engage in the services that you guys offer?
Yeah, it's individualized. It's dependent on the situation. Different family situations are factored in, certainly to what the support system looks like for a given client. But anyone who comes our way gets an assessment of kind of what their situation is, and then an individualized treatment plan that may include individual therapeutic interventions. But we also have a lot of group interventions, and that's important because connection really is indispensable in healing from mental health issues. In fact, that's kind of the issue with a lot of what causes something to become a disorder, is it creates the isolation and the separation.
A quick follow-up to that then would be, how would we know when it's time to seek out an organization like Hope Recovery?
I would say that being unhappy is not normal for your daily experience.
Just going through life like that.
Yeah, it's normal to be sad, and it's normal to feel your emotions, then you should feel them. But being unhappy or being numb might even be a more prevalent feeling that our young adults have. That's not how life's supposed to be. So if that's your normal, if you're not happy, if you're not at peace, if you feel numb and you don't know what to do and you feel stuck, then reach out. Mm-hmm. You don't have to live that way. And there's a much better way to live, and there are modalities that can help you resolve your issues, whatever they are.
That's an encouraging statement.
Yeah, a lot of hope that comes from that. We've been visiting with David McFarland and Jennifer Doberful Quinlan, the co-founders of Hope Recovery and Healing. It's an organization that's focused on helping people burdened by trauma, mental health conditions, and emotional wounds to discover their truth and create their path to wholeness. If you would like to find more information, you can go online to hoperecoveryandhealing.com. Jennifer and David, thanks for being on the show with us.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up in 5 minutes, how does increased access to global media change American culture?
Lavender, lemon balm, lemongrass, lemon verbena, mace, marjoram, nutmeg, oregano. It's your morning buzz right after this.
For listening to The Lisa Show. Are you afraid your kid is going to get homesick while they're away this summer? In 20 minutes, we're going to hear from two summer camp veterans on how you can prep them to have the best summer ever. But first, it's time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. This first one, sad. Ernie Lively, the father of Blake Lively, who played her on-screen dad in the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, was an almost 50-year acting career. He died at the age of 74 with complications from a cardiac arrest. You might remember him from such films, not only The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, and also the sequel, Don't worry, I watched both of them. You can also see him in Passenger 57, 2018's Looking Glass, in addition to TV appearances on The Dukes of Hazzard, The X-Files, Renegade, The West Wing. One of his first credited roles was on an episode of The Waltons back in 1975. Also, my classic, Man in the Moon. You remember that movie back from 1991?
Yeah.
Ernie Lively has passed. Also, if you are of a certain generation, you remember the little Datsun trucks. You remember your little compact Datsun truck?
Oh,
or
yeah.
The little Mitsubishi truck?
Yeah.
He also had, I think, Volkswagen had a little truck in there for a while.
You never see those.
Well, the battle of the compact pickup trucks is back.
What?
Announced just recently, you got the Ford Maverick. That's what Ford's bringing to the party. And the Hyundai Santa Cruz going to be launching at the same time, competing head-to-head in the marketplace. It's a few months away, but you can see pictures of what the Ford Maverick and the Hyundai Santa Cruz look like. And then finally this. It is National Herb and Spice Day.
Okay, that's why you were rattling off delicious flavors.
I was just excited about all these different flavors and tastes. Ginger, fenugreek, fennel, tarragon, thyme, turmeric, vanilla, wasabi, sorrel. I also would like to point out that I learned this morning, allspice is not just a combination of all the spices into one thing.
Because how could you get all the spices into one?
Well, if you take a little of each of them, I thought
no,
that's what it was.
Too much.
Nope. It's an entirely different thing and called allspice for a completely different reason. So if you celebrate no other way this National Herb and Spice Day, celebrating it by telling people, hey, you know what? Allspice? It's not all the
not
spices.
What you think it is.
It's just a spice among many spices. Celebrate them today, won't you please? That's your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Compared to the rest of the world, America has been long lacking in international film visibility. However, American audiences are no longer able to turn a blind eye to international films, as foreign films are quickly making a breakthrough into the American market in a very dramatic way. And one of these international films that has taken America by storm is the box office shattering Japanese anime film Demon Slayer: Infinity Train. Now, Demon Slayer success in the box office has overtaken big American productions such as Mortal Kombat and Tenet, and has broken several box office records. And this film and the major successes that it's won worldwide amidst a pandemic appear to be the first step towards reshaping the way that American audiences and theaters approach viewing foreign films. So here to talk about the success of Demon Slayer: Infinity Train and what that says about what we might see in the box office moving forward is Raphael Mayer, who is a film and TV critic. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Raphael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is Demon Slayer: Infinity Train all about for those of us who are unfamiliar?
Yeah, so what makes this film special, I think, is the fact that it's not, usually when it comes to anime movies, they're usually spin-offs or shall we say, non-canon stories that anyone can just watch without any prior knowledge, mostly as a way to advertise the main show. But this is the sequel to the first season of Demon Slayer, an anime show from 2019, if I remember correctly, which pretty much took the world by storm within the anime community. That show sort of came out of nowhere. It wasn't like hugely anticipated compared to like other shows, but it quickly gained a really strong fan base via word of mouth as the season went on. So by the time they announced that the continuation was not going to be a second season, but this movie, it created a huge anticipation. And now the story, after what makes the special is that after the you watch the movie, then you... it leads directly into season two of the show.
So what is it about this film and franchise that you think has made it so popular with audiences around the world?
It just takes what we know, like action anime shows, and it does it incredibly well. The story is about a young boy who loses his family to an attack by demons in a world where, like, demons are around us and they attack people and kill people. And in order to save his sister, the only one who survived but was turned into a demon, he joins this elite group of warriors in order to find a cure. And what the show does so well is that it has really complex and relatable characters. Every character in the show has a lot of both like background and motivation, and their personalities are really unique and almost palpable in that way. Just the animation is absolutely stunning. Studio Ufotable did an incredible job in making the action scenes flow like water and almost in a rhythmic sense, kind of.
Yeah.
And also it's going on in recent years where these sort of action, what you would say, sort of YA type of anime for young kids that mix action with horror elements. So the show, again, like, as I mentioned, it deals with demons. So there's a lot of horror-like imagery and violence in a way that's done not gratuitously. I mean, it does a little bit, but it's mostly like the horror of it. And we see it through the eyes of the main character who's just horrified by what he sees. And yet he fights because he's trying to protect those he loves.
It's a fascinating kind of perspective that we're taking on this particular film for a couple of reasons. One, a TV show that says, hey, you know what? You're going to need to watch the movie if you need the continuation of the story. Yep. That's risky. But then also that this has all come out during a worldwide pandemic when people aren't going to the theaters. What has that journey been like for this film, and why is it succeeding where other films are not?
Absolutely. From what I understand, that the movie was put into production like as soon as the anime like premiere, basically, as soon as like the first few episodes hit and it was starting to gain traction, a movie sequel was greenlit, mostly because the story being told doesn't really fit into like a longer season. So I said, okay, let's do a short movie, like a 2-hour, less than a 2-hour long movie. And releasing in the pandemic, it's funny because, like, from what I understand, it in Japan basically opened up its theaters just for this movie. They had, like, everywhere else in the world, the few theaters that were open had, like, a bunch of restrictions and there had to be a certain number of seats in between each person. But for this particular movie, they dropped all of that. They were at the time starting to be better in terms of case numbers and all of that. So they felt safe enough to welcome people into theaters just the weekend that this movie came out, pretty much for this. And people seem to really respond to that. People like flocked to theaters. And it instantly started like smashing records left and right. As I said, mostly because like there's a mix of there's not that many movies showing up.
Yeah,
this is Japanese box office tends to be more centered towards like local productions, especially in terms of anime. Unlike the U.S., they do go to theaters to see animated movies, especially their own. So you have that compared to like how we would do in the U.S., for example. But you also have a show that has been slowly building up hype and anticipation around it. The manga ended, I think, in early 2020, like a few months before the movie opened. So everyone who watched the first season went on to catch up on the manga and then finished reading that. And they were like, okay, now we need more. And there's this movie coming out, so let's go watch that. So I think that helped make this such an event compared to something like Tenet, when he also had like a weird release date internationally compared to in the U.S. and all of that.
If you're just jumping in on the conversation, we're talking with Rafael Motemayor about Demon Slayer Infinity Train and its huge success as of late. And we've been really discussing why it's been such a phenomenon, especially being a Japanese animation sort that's a continuation of the first season in a movie form. And I'm wondering how you think that the success of Demon Slayer is going to change the way that foreign films are really received, especially in America. Do you think that we'll start seeing this sort of model of continuing the story in a movie form continue here in the States?
I think at least in animation, it's definitely been already talked about. There were a couple of shows that aired last year and this year that people were wondering, are they going to continue it as a movie because of this huge success of Demon Slayer? I think one of them, recent anime called Jujutsu Kaisen, already had an anime prequel announced. As far as U.S. productions go, I think live action is a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
If only because, like, you know, there's always the stigma, like, contracts and like, even the kind of actors that do TV versus movies, it's always, like, a difference there.
Okay.
But we did see an example of this, a continuation between two movie format with Veronica Mars a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What made that different is that that show got canceled, then brought back as a movie, then canceled again, then revived as a TV show.
Yeah.
This is a rare case where, like, it's been planned from before.
Okay.
So they knew the plan was to make a movie first and then go back to a second season.
Well, it just seems to open up the possibilities for, you know, this the creative expression in a different way. We just think that's one model and it seems to have upended it. Another aspect of the movie I wanted to ask you about is that it's rated R in the United States, and that's not very common for an animated film here. Why does it have this rating?
It's funny because I believe the show just the equivalent of PG-13 in Japan. And I know that when the movie came out, it was like really popular amongst kids. So it's been a bit of a surprise to see it rated R. But the movie still has like a lot of violence. That's like there's no doubt about it. And it does have some really dark moments, but it's always in service of this personal story of this boy who's seen so much loss and death, and that gives him an appreciation of life. And he's like really empathetic towards the creatures that he has to kill because he understands that they did not choose to be this way, you know? So like, I feel like there's a purpose to it, but it's still like, it earns its rating.
Okay.
How does that play in the US? I feel like, in recent years, we have seen a lot, at least in the TV, where we have seen a lot of popular sort of mature R-rated anime. For example, Attack on Titan, which was a huge success a couple of years ago, and it continues to be. So I do think that especially American audiences want something within animation that's separate from the kind of family-friendly or kid-focused movies that or TV shows that like Cartoon Network or Disney or Pixar serve them.
So a question kind of circling back to where we started this, where in the United States we haven't been maybe as open to international films in the past as it seems like we are present. What do we stand to gain by bringing in things like anime and other stories from, you know, different countries? What as a film culture, what are we going to gain from being open to all films from all places?
I think that it's twofold. I think for one, you are seeing types of stories that you don't normally see at home. You see that there's more to what TV has to offer, what you can do with TV than what we see in American productions. But also it influences, and in a way it sort of forces American productions to step up and experiment. We saw that in the 80s and 90s, when a bunch of both live action and animated productions started becoming more open to anime and Japanese animation, and everything was like influenced by that. Even like I know, for example, the Star Wars prequels and the Star Wars animated show was heavily influenced by anime, and shows like Avatar: The Last Airbender was hugely influenced by Japanese animation. So I feel like the more we open audiences and also creatives and artists to international films and international TV and international productions, we open both audiences and creators to new opportunities. And that just that mix and match of things just makes for better stories, I feel.
It's an exciting future and one that I look forward to getting more and
better movies. Great.
Varied
Bring it
stories
on.
Here. We've been visiting with Rafael Motamayor, is a writer and weekend news editor at Collider. He writes for Film and TV Critic with a focus on animation. If you want to find out more about Rafael, you can go to his Twitter feed, which is Rafael Motamayor. Thanks for being on the show with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, learn how you can help your kids love their time away from home this summer.
I'm going to do my very best to not sing Hello Mudda, Hello Fada as we talk about summer camp. You're listening to The Lisa Show. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Summer camp is a really great way to get your kids engaged in really fun activities, make some lasting memories, make new friends, and of course, make a lot of s'mores, I'm assuming. You know, I like to think of these things as like expansive experiences for your kids.
I say it's not summer if there's not s'mores, so...
Yeah.
I'm in. I'm no sort of ruler. I don't get to make the laws or pick the laws. But if I could, it's not summer without s'mores.
You know, all across the country right now, parents and kids are having these conversations about what to expect in the summer and for summer camp. And knowing that it is, under the best circumstances, certainly a big change and a new experience. This is something that we can navigate because it kind of, I think, connects us cross-generationally, right? Mm-hmm. At the time that I went away for summer camp. Mm-hmm. Do you have good memories about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have sort of two memories about it. One is it's like, I'm so independent. Mm-hmm.
This is
I'm
a going big deal.
Off. Do I have my – and I remember going through like the checklist making sure that I had everything. Mom, I need a handkerchief. You'll never use a handkerchief. It's on the list, Mom. I need
one.
Oh,
that's sweet.
Sort of all of those elements of that. And then I remember getting to the summer camp and recognizing that it was going to be multiple days and going, I hadn't really thought through all of this being away from home.
You know, a lot of kids are particularly tenderhearted.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way to say that they might need a little extra maybe preparation or just an attitude going in that might be different from other kids.
I mean, just think about as adults when we look at doing something new, something we've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us go, yeah, you bet. And others go, whoa, hey, what are we doing here?
And especially if this is their first experience going away and how your kid responds to homesickness is crucial to their summer camp experience. So we thought that it would be a really great way to talk about not only homesickness, right, but summer camp and how you can make it really the best experience ever. So we've got John Jay here. He's a camp director for Clear Creek Summer Camp, an outdoor education camp that teaches kids about the importance and excitement of nature. And we thought that he'd be a great person to talk about how do you get your kid excited for summer camp. Welcome.
Good morning, Lisa. Richie, how are both of you?
We're really great. And, you know, going down, I think, memory lane a little bit, too.
Yeah, I'm sort of wishing that I was putting together that packing list and going away to a summer camp.
Well, that combination of excitement and a little trepidation, having a new experience, in your experience as a leader here of a lot of different kids who've experienced this, when do kids usually start to realize that they're going to get a little homesick?
So that's probably a discussion that should happen well before they come to camp, but they should be involved in the decision-making of, you know, is this an experience that I've bought into myself? Is this something that I actually want to do? This is not something that a parent should be forcing a child that does not want to be involved to do. But certainly if they're involved in that decision-making process, and then before a parent drops a child off at a camp, the discussion should be held that this is what you can expect, and it is normal to feel anxious and homesick, and this is maybe some ways you can deal with that.
Well, before we get into that, I wonder when we identify that, does it always happen, on the camp side within the first few nights, or can it happen when you know, throughout the entire camp?
You know, there are so many different ways that campers deal with that, but I believe so. Initially, is going to be the first day or two are going to be maybe the hardest. And really, it might take several days to the term is maybe getting the summer out of, I mean, getting the city out of a child. And so being away from home and the routine and the, you know, the city, the screen time, that's something that can take a few days. And so, yeah, it's to be expected that it's not going to happen right off the bat. Some kids may get into a camp 3 or 4 days and then realize, wow, this is a little longer than what I had.
Can I call my mom? Well, I'm sure that because there are so many different kinds of kids that go to summer camp, that there must be different kinds of signs of homesickness that present themselves in different ways that we might not expect. From your perspective, what are some of those ways that are some things that we could look for, either as parents or as camp counselors, for signs of homesickness that are kind of unusual?
Well, it'll always begin with isolation. So we will do everything possible to include every child and make sure they understand they're an important part of this team or this group. As soon as we see the eyes going down and we're kind of shuffling through the activities without really engaging or jumping into them with both feet, then that'll give us a clue that maybe this is a child that'll need a little extra support.
Hmm.
Now, as you've been a support to these kids that are homesick, technology over the years that you've been a summer camp worker director have certainly changed. Does modern technology make it easier for kids to be able to then connect and then kind of get back to it, put their worries to rest?
Let me clarify what you're asking there. Are you asking camp? Are we accessing that technology?
Yeah, because I would
think... Yeah, does it make it better or does it make it worse?
There are sometimes these kids that all they need to do is just be able to check back in with their parents, know that everything is fine, and then the homesickness can go away. Is that something that you guys do with the campers, or is it a, they're gone, you'll be back, everything will be fine?
You know, in our camp is maybe a little different. We are at a much shorter period of time than maybe we've been away before. And so we do everything we can to make sure that they realize that home is there and everything is fine. But right now we are in the moment. We are going to be in this beautiful setting and this is, and we're going to avoid screen time. You know, there'll be opportunities in the big room and in assemblies to access a big screen. And we'll be showing them, you know, some presentations that way. But as far as like regular communication at home on the phone and in an email sort of a thing, we let them know that we're sending pictures home to their parents every day. And sometimes that's enough connection for them to understand, okay, they know that I'm here and they know that I'm in a safe place.
Why do you think that some children are more prone to feeling homesick than others?
Well, I was in the same boat, I know. And honestly, when I was a child, I recall being homesick from even just a few minutes away from my mom. I guess I love this mom a lot, but I felt as though if I didn't have her constant attention, you know, and then something wasn't quite right. And maybe a lot of kids are going through something like that. Job one for us is just to create an environment where it's a quick-paced, fun, exciting, novel, and yet predictable routine where the kids understand that this is something new and this is not going to last forever, but it's something that I need to be taking advantage of because not every kid gets this chance. And so we want them to feel as though this is a wonderful opportunity that they will only have just this once.
Yeah.
We use a lot of fun songs and choral responses that they're going to have to learn, and they're working together, and it kind of builds unity and it helps them understand that, yeah, this is something new and I'm going to remember this forever. And we just want to keep instilling that idea.
We're talking about summer camp and specifically homesickness with John J. Harris. You mentioned songs, John J., and
he's not going to let you get away with that.
No, you don't just get to throw that out there. I don't know if you want to just present a song or try and teach us a song, but I would love to know a song that might help prevent summer camp homesickness?
Well, I don't know if any of it specifically prevent that. The idea of these songs is just a fun way for kids to interact with an entire group and feel as though they're part of something fun and special. And a lot of these songs, they may happen right there. Some of the verses may be unique to that group of kids, and maybe they're helping to create some of these songs. And so, well, for instance, I don't know if you're a child of the 80s or the 90s where we had what was the name of that cartoon? Well, you remembered. If I'll bring it up. Every morning I'll greet the kids the same way. I'll say, "Hey, kids, what are we going to do today?" And their response must always be the same. "Same thing we do every day, Mr. Harris. Try and take over the world." Little things like that where they were feeling as though, you know, they're part of a group. And they didn't do that the day before when they were at home. But now we have something new, and this is kind of fun. And little things like that where it just helps build some unity and some just fun. We want these kids smiling all day long.
Ren and Stimpy is the cartoon that you're talking about.
Ren and Stimpy, there we are.
Yep.
What are we doing?
Same thing
today?
We do every day.
So from a parent's perspective, if your kid does call you from camp and maybe they're having a rough time and they want to come home, they're homesick, but you know that they're safe and that they would really regret it if you came and picked him up. What are some good things for parents to say to support what you're doing at camp?
So before I have a child talk to a parent, I will always talk to the parent first and remind them that they are the ones who are in charge of this situation. You know, the child will try to take over. And as I hand the phone over to a child, they understand that this will be a respectful call, that we're not going to be yelling at a parent to come and pick me up, get me out of here. This is an opportunity for you to touch base and understand that your parents are fine and that they're happy with where you are and they have confidence that you're safe. But if you need to talk for a few minutes just to renew the familiarity with what's going on, then that's fine. But we don't encourage those home calls unless they're absolutely necessary. We would much rather help these kids find someone else in camp. You know, and if they can find one good friend in camp, that's going to make a lot of difference. If they can help somebody else who may be needing their support too, that goes a long way to just jump outside of yourself and see that, I'm helping somebody else have a good time here too. That can really, really help.
Do you see the occurrences of homesickness either increase or decrease over the years that you've been working?
Well, decrease, and this is why our camp, because it is not able to accommodate all of the children who would like to be there, has necessarily had to shorten the time that the children are there. And so that, I mean, in itself is going to have an impact on that. You know, if a kid is away from home for 3 days as opposed to 5 days, there are camps around the country that are extended, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. So in our specific situation, we don't see as much of the homesick. In a group of 100 children, we might see one or two that we're having to support through maybe day two or day three. But then even those kids are doing just fine after that.
On a bigger level, for those who are considering or who think, I would never even send my kid, I think, just to sleepaway camp. Talk to me a little bit about or explain the value of summer camp for kids. And, you know, kind of as an entryway to that conversation with your kid of like, hey, this might be good for you because what's your perspective?
Right. Oh, boy, that's a whole nother topic for a whole nother day, and I hope you address it. But there's a book called The Last Child in the Woods, but it addresses something called nature deficit disorder. And our whole society is having a real issue with screen time and with children not accessing the outdoors. And even when they are, it's different than when we were growing up, possibly. You know, they don't have the same latitude to just play with the environment that we did, you know. And then there's safety things that, of course, have to be taken into account. But we're no longer going out for hours at a time into the woods and building stick homes and then damming the stream and those sorts of things, you know, that maybe we remember from – a generation or two ago, but they need that experience. And I always tell children, I hope that you have opportunity this summer or sometime to go to grandma's house or a little town where you are away from electronics, where you can go out into the yard and hear the guy three blocks away mowing their lawn. You know, you just are not getting away from the constant. I tell them that boredom mm-hmm. is a gateway to memories and a gateway to ingenuity, it's not a bad thing. Do not fight the boredom.
Get
to a place where you can just be in the moment and make your own games and make your own fun mm-hmm. and not have to have a screen in front of you to be engaged.
John, we've got just about a minute left with you, and I would be curious. You mentioned that you were kind of that sensitive child, that you really had the love and yearning to be with your mom, you know, a lot of the time, but you certainly have this passion for camp, specifically the summer camp. Was it an experience that you had when you were younger, or is this something that you found when you were older? And what is it about it for you that makes you so passionate?
Well, you know, it probably began as a summer opportunity for a teacher to work, you know, but it didn't take long for me to see the impact that it had on these kids, where they were just coming away feeling as though they have just accomplished something really special. And they did, you know, within a 5-day period, it helps a child to mature a lot. And that's something that there's an important discussion to have with kids, you know, with parents, but also with a camp staff, just to let the child know what they're accomplishing right now, how they're growing, and how this can impact them, not just this week, but forever on. And to appreciate the outdoors, the environment, and then to appreciate their own sense of you know, growth.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Harris, mm-hmm. John J. Harris, camp director for Clear Creek Summer Camp, an outdoor education camp that's located near Schofield, Utah. Thank you so much for being on the show and helping us talk about this important thing, this summertime homesickness. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You know, it's really exciting to think about the opportunities that you can give your kids, mm-hmm. you know, like this, and to go on an adventure.
And you think about giving your kids an adventure, giving them the opportunity to maybe be a little homesick. Why not go to BYUradio.org? You can go to /adventure, or you can find it just from the homepage, BYUradio.org, and enter to win an annual National Parks Pass from Lisa's Adventure Club, giving away our first family pass on tomorrow's Lisa
it's
Show.
It's exciting. Tomorrow we're going to be giving away our first annual National Parks Pass. Don't forget to enter for a chance to win.
Do it right now. Otherwise, guess what? I make you 100% promise that if you don't enter, you can't win. We will not be calling you if you've not entered.
Coming up next, we're talking about the perfect food pairings. You're not going to want to miss that.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Are you ready to stop screaming for ice cream? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to learn about several heat-free summer treats you can make at home.
I will never stop screaming for ice cream.
I wondered.
So we have our work cut out for us. Think about the Billboard Hot 100.
Okay.
What song do you suppose has been on the Billboard Hot 100 for the longest amount of time?
Oh, I don't know.
Answer coming up in your morning buzz. As a young child, I remember thinking that I was special when I got to have a sleepover at my grandparents' house.
Oh, that's sweet. What good memories.
Not all of the grandkids got to sleep over. In fact, they would select one grandchild to be able to sleep over because they liked to have the one-on-one time with the grandkid. There would be times where they would do multiples, but there was a lot of boys.
That's a lot of work.
It's a lot of boys, and I'm pretty sure they were like, let's just do one. They're a little more tame.
Yeah.
Now, some of the things that would come into play when you had a sleepover at my grandparents' house were mm-hmm. was you'd have a nice cooked meal by my grandma at the same time. It was at 5 p.m. because that's when a good family eats dinner.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
they were very
rules.
They were very
but it's sweet because then you get to get to know your grandparents mm-hmm, and they're mm-hmm. you know in a different way. You never forgot that.
That was part of it. Another thing we would play either a game of gin rummy at the table,
cute.
Where we would bet, and if we bet money, my grandpa would keep the money that I bet. He would not give it back and be like, never learn, you know, don't ever bet again. He'd be like, thank you for your money. I appreciate that. It would, or maybe a game of triominoes, right? But one thing it's a game.
Okay.
Look it up.
Anyway,
you'll love it for your summer parties. But one thing that I sort of sticks out to me in my mind is that it also meant that if you were real lucky, you got to have part of, we called my grandfather Papa. You got to have part of Papa's treats.
And
there were two different kind of Papa's treats.
Okay.
There were the sweet treats and the savory treats. And the sweet treats was you'd get an Eskimo pie from the freezer for dessert, right? You knew that you had done what you were supposed to, that you had behaved accordingly, because you didn't get an Eskimo pie. It wasn't assumed that you'd get an Eskimo pie every time.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be offered the Eskimo pie. And then you knew you were sort of in good graces. And then also, he would sit down to saltines and ketchup.
What?
And that was just sort of a kind of a way that he wouldn't eat a whole row like I sometimes do, but would just eat a few saltines and some ketchup. And I never participated in that. I sort of just stood
back and said,
I'm good. Well, okay, that's your thing, Papa. That's your combination. And I was sort of reminiscing on that memory recently and thought, you know, that's sort of an odd pairing. You're sort of
really
turning
is.
Your nose down
yeah,
at
I'm
it.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of when I would crave that. Listen, I love a good saltine, but like with a chunk of cheese.
Yeah. Mm. Yesterday, my wife indulges in the pretty popular, but maybe odd combination to some folks.
Okay.
The peanut butter banana combination.
Oh, well, I'm a big fan of the peanut butter banana combination.
So it has got me thinking about combinations that we maybe have not considered.
Okay. Unusual food pairings?
Yeah.
Or
delicious and unusual. Opening our mind. I love food. I'll talk about food all the time. I'll eat food anytime someone presents it to me, even if I'm not hungry. I'll go, yeah, you know, let me try a little bit of that. How about delicious food pairings that you likely have not considered?
Okay,
are you ready for this?
Maybe we'll change our mind and try something new. Okay.
Now, some of them, admittedly, you're going to go, I don't think so, Richie. Nice try.
So you're not talking about like chocolate and mint, because that's a great food
yeah,
pairing.
Of course.
Yeah, you're not.
Are you thinking about chocolate and peanut butter? I've heard they're good together.
No, listen, though, because I was talking about this last night with a group of friends, and because we were eating chocolate mint brownies.
Yeah, no.
And some people were like, gross, I don't like mint with brownie, you know, with chocolate. And then we were talking about what other combination. Like, this same person also didn't like orange with chocolate.
Yeah, I'm not
and
a fan
I
of fruits with chocolate.
That I like everything with chocolate.
Yeah, okay. So it's not, ordinarily paired things with other ordinarily paired things.
All right.
This will give you an example. How about pickles and peanut butter?
No.
Okay. But people will say and have touted that as a delicious combination.
Although one time I had pickles and strawberry ice cream, and I really liked that.
This one, likely you have tried before and didn't even realize it was an odd combination.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe people have given you a glance where you're like, huh? I found this to be most delicious when I dipped my French fries into my Frosty.
Oh, yeah.
But on a broader scale, how about just ice cream and fries?
Yeah.
And not just having ice cream and then having fries or vice versa, combining the two.
That's a good combo.
Chocolate and avocado. You have sort of the sweet from the chocolate and the...
I don't think you would taste the avocado.
The cream from the avocado.
Do people do this?
But can you imagine? Yes.
I mean, on the internet,
of course people do it.
If I needed extra like healthy fat, I might put an avocado like in a chocolate protein shake, but I don't think I...
So in other places, certainly not where we're here, is in a milkshake. So you would have chocolate in your avocado milkshake. And if you're thinking avocado milkshake, try it. You'll never have a creamier milkshake than something like that. How about olive oil and ice cream?
I would have said, if you had asked me this 2 months ago, I would have said, gross, wait, what? But I have a friend who makes homemade ice cream, and he brought some over, and he said, I'm not going to tell you what this flavor is. Guess. And I ate it, and I was like, this is so good, but I couldn't put my finger on it. It was olive oil ice cream. It was amazing.
Yep. You can likely find it. It's starting to be a little bit popular in gelato, especially, where you can find olive oil and ice cream or your gelatos. Okay. I know you like yourself a Coke. You drink 9 or 10 every morning.
No shame.
No shame. No shame. Go ahead. Take a sip.
Just a second.
How about Coke and chicken? Now, not just drinking a Coke and eating fried chicken.
Okay.
But it's starting to become popular for frying chicken in a Coke-based product.
Frying chicken in a Coke-based product.
Right, so you sort of
I'm going to have to think about that.
So you sort of get the sweet of the Coke
on
your fried chicken. All right.
Well, I marinate like a pork loin in Dr. Pepper.
Right, same kind of thing.
And put it in like a slow cooker or an Instapot.
Right, right. So like
Coke
that, but
and chicken.
But fried. So
but
you get sort of the crispy Coke. How about strawberries and balsamic?
Oh, yeah. I'm all about that. Over vanilla ice cream? Yes, please.
All right. And some people are hearing that and going, wait, what is this?
It's so easy. You just chop up a bunch of strawberries and have it like a balsamic, either like a reduction, like where you just let it boil and simmer. Oh, it's so good over vanilla ice cream.
I want to make sure that I get to these. I have
a
bunch.
Sorry.
And so we're blowing people's minds with odd food combinations, the combining of things that you like both of them, but you've never tried them together. This one I thought I should at least try once. How about cheddar cheese and apple pie? You've done this before?
Yeah.
You're nodding in agreement?
Yeah, I'll do that one.
I've done this at a professional establishment. Peanut butter and a hamburger. So instead, instead of mayonnaise or ketchup, you toast the bun and you gotta get a good peanut butter toasted bun. So the peanut butter gets sort of runny like your mayo or your ketchup,
and then
yeah. But I would really recommend eating it while it's hot. If you let the peanut butter get cool,
I'm gonna try it this summer. I'm gonna try it.
It's worth trying. How about chocolate and chips, that being potato chips?
Oh, yeah.
So you get a little of the salty from the potato and then the chocolate. I feel like chocolate is a lot of these pairings.
Well, I feel like if you make a chocolate chip cookie and you crumble some potato chips on the top and then eat them, you're not going to be disappointed.
Mm. Bananas and bacon?
I've never had that. Bananas and bacon.
Yeah. It's a sweet, carb-heavy banana paired with creamy peanut butter and salty bacon. So it's just adding bacon to your peanut butter banana sandwich, essentially.
Hmm.
How about prosciutto and melon?
Oh, yes. That's one of my
You get the melon and
favorite.
You wrap it in prosciutto.
Yeah.
Peanut butter pickle sandwiches?
No.
I'm not much of a pickle person. It's the vinegary thing for me. How about chicken and pickle brine?
Chicken and pickle brine. Well, I like a fried chicken sandwich with pickles on it. Does that count?
Yes.
If it drips.
I'll allow it. I didn't think this one was so odd as we're talking about like odd food combinations, but pizza.
Yeah.
And ranch dressing. Like I feel
now welcome to the Midwest.
Yeah, I feel a lot of people do that. I don't feel like that's as weird as maybe
we dipped
some
everything
of these
in
other
ranch
ones.
Dressing when I was a teenager.
Everything.
No, really.
Is that the neighbor? Yeah, he's dripped
cheese
in.
Cheese sandwiches, pizza, breadsticks.
How about ketchup and ranch dressing? The combo of ketchup and ranch dressing?
I've tried it before, but I feel like if you're from the state of Utah, which I am, that you know about this thing called fry sauce.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't do that.
How about blueberries?
Mm-hmm.
You like a blueberry?
I love it.
And steak?
I've never heard that.
Blueberry-based sauces for your steak. The fruit is sweet, but it's not too sweet. It won't overpower the meat's flavor. There are a bajillion recipes for blueberries and steak.
Okay, so this is a food challenge for me. I'm going to do the peanut butter on the hamburger, and I'm going to do a blueberry sauce on the steak. Mm-hmm. Sure.
This one I didn't think was too weird as well. Watermelon and salt. Doing a little dash of salt on your watermelon.
I've never done that. Have you?
Yeah. You've never done that, really?
No, I squeeze lime juice on my watermelon.
That's sort of a tangy way to go about it. Try your salt with it.
I'll try it.
Yeah. I'm surprised.
I really would try it. No,
that's more mainstream than I thought.
I didn't know it was mainstream. Sea salt?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try it.
Don't do too much, otherwise you'll feel like you're licking a salt lick.
Okay.
Nobody wants that. It's a cold, juicy salt lick.
All right.
Pickles and ice cream, that seems to be the butt of a lot of jokes as we combine things. Maybe like for the stereotypical pregnant woman joke. It's pickles
but
and ice cream.
One day I did really, really crave strawberry ice creams and pickles, and I ate it, and I was expecting.
Mm-hmm. Expecting what?
A baby. And expecting to really enjoy my meal.
And I did.
And I did.
Strawberry and basil, which you mentioned. Mm. Mango and chili powder.
So I've seen this, and I haven't. I haven't.
I think it's a South American thing.
Yeah.
I have not.
Sounds good, but I've never tried it.
I just like a sweet mango. I wonder what the chili powder would add to that.
That's your food challenge.
Okay. Sesame and chocolate. Again, another chocolate that we add to this whole thing.
You can add anything to chocolate. I'm going to eat it.
Doesn't matter. Peanut butter and bacon. Now we're back to bacon and peanut butter. Yeah, I feel like I need
to. I feel like that's really being pushed on me.
Sriracha and peanut butter?
No, stop it. No.
Oh, okay. How about French fries and honey rather than a ketchup or,
never
mustard
tried
or something
that,
like
and
that?
I love a French fry probably more than most things.
Speaking on honey, let's talk about honey and pizza.
Okay, so I've had, and I see this in a lot of pizza places where they're doing like a sausage with a hot honey drizzled on it. So hot honey is really hot right now.
Yeah, it's so hot.
No,
right
really,
now.
Like a flavor infused honey. So I feel like this is becoming a trend.
You heard it here first on the Lisa Show. Hot sauce and ice cream instead of your chocolate sauce. Do a little.
No.
She won't allow that.
No, I don't allow it.
Nope. Green apples and salsa. So instead of.
I'm making a face.
Yeah, I can tell.
Like, I'm imagining what. Why? Why would you do that?
Oh, because the tangy offsets the maybe the spice or the like richness of the tomato. If you're not so much a tomato person,
I don't want to put tomatoes and apples together.
It's also a consistency thing because the crunchy of the green apple,
yeah, like a chip.
Yeah, give you something to it.
I still
want
a chip.
Give you something to it. How about miso and butternut squash?
I don't know. I'm gonna have to think about that one.
You love a feta.
I love a feta.
Watermelon and feta.
Yes.
In fact,
I just gave that recipe to somebody yesterday.
And then finally, get ready to stick your nose up in the air on this one.
Okay.
Peanut butter and mayonnaise. To me.
Why would you eat that? Like, what would you put it on?
Well, it's a Southern tradition. It came about in the Depression. It stuck around for years, especially in the South. It gives me no reason why I should do this, only
but
that it's the thing that's in the
more
cell.
I think about it, I love both of those condiments. Are they condiments?
Yeah, they're condiments.
I'll put them together. I'd try it.
Yeah, it would have to.
On some white bread?
I am a mayonnaise has to be cold guy. If it's warm, I don't trust it.
Yeah, no.
Am I going to die? This mayonnaise is warm. Am I going to die right now? I've combined it with peanut butter.
Odd food pairings, and I would be interested to see which odd food pairing goes from which part of the country, because I do feel like, you know, my reaction, your reaction is where we grew up and what we're used to seeing, tasting together. And you don't know until you try it.
Yeah. You've got your challenges.
You turned your nose up
at a few of those.
I know I did.
Consider yourself dared. Wait. Consider yourself double dog. Wait.
What?
Consider yourself triple dog dared. And for those who think you can't triple dog dare a double dog, you're wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, Well, continuing our look at food, but maybe a little bit more traditional or family-friendly flavors, something that everyone will like. We're excited to have Tara Teaspoon on, who's going to join us to talk about heatless summer treats.
And we're talking about the Billboard Hot 100. What song do you suppose has been on the Hot 100 for the longest? Answer coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
for listening to The Lisa Show. Are you looking for a fun weekend trip? In 20 minutes, we're going to be hearing all about San Juan National Historic Site. But first, we've got your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online. People are talking about this, and as water cooler discussion returns, yeah. I happen to know for a fact there is a water cooler somewhere in these United States where someone will be talking about one of these three things, which I'm just about to talk to you about. Netflix has a movie called Awake. It's a sci-fi thriller starring Gina Rodriguez as a mom protecting her children during an extinction event, which seems to me like an event you don't want to have because you can only have it one time if it's an extinction event. The question being asked is, what happens when everyone in the world loses the ability to fall asleep?
Oh, man. It's like everyone's nightmare. What a great idea for a thriller.
So it's getting a lot of great touting online. It is over on Netflix. Be warned, if you go searching for anything about it on the internet, spoilers aplenty.
Oh, really?
So make sure you watch it. They give you a warning like, hey, that was a spoiler that you just read. But check it out. It's called Awake. Also over on Disney Plus, Loki. You're Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, I've been excited because I feel like this is going to bring families together. I'm always looking for something that I can watch with my kids.
It's a 6-part series on Disney Plus. It's getting rave reviews from folks that had the opportunity to see it. Yeah.
I'm nervous because, you know, when something's so highly anticipated.
Sure.
And then it comes out and then it gets reviewed, you know.
And then people are saying, and what are they saying?
Yeah.
The big thing has been that Tom, who's played Loki for 10 years.
That's crazy.
That's the thing that people are saying.
Oh,
it's
I
been
didn't
10
even,
years
yeah,
since he first started doing it.
Yeah, 10 years. Good for him.
Looking back at the past decade and obviously reviews about it. And then finally this, put your music knowledge to work here, Lisa Valentine Clark.
Got it.
We're talking about the Billboard Hot 100.
Okay.
Think for a minute. What do you think the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100? That means it spent
the most weeks
on the Hot 100. Not necessarily that it was the top of the Hot 100.
Okay, just maybe
like a real great song. Mm-hmm. Maybe it came on slow and was there for a long time. I'll give you a couple of hints.
Okay.
AWOL Nation's Sail, you know that song. Da 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 da. That was on there for 79 weeks.
Wow.
This song, which I'm about to tell you about, just passed Jason Mraz's I'm Yours.
Okay.
You know that song.
Yeah.
So the number two song now officially from The Weeknd, it's Blinding Lights, has now been on
How's that go?
It's the one that sounds like A-ha's Take on Me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, whenever I play events, I will play them back to back and watch people go, is this the same song?
Oh, that's funny.
The number one song, which is sort of the, you know, it's the marker. It's where The Weeknd has its sights set on is Imagine Dragons' Radioactive, which spent 89 weeks on the Hot 100. Yeah, so it's number two. We've got a new number two aiming for number one. Congratulations, The Weeknd. That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Have you ever wondered why we say ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream? Why do we say it? Do kids say that anymore?
Is it marketing? It's got to be some sort of marketing thing, right?
I feel like that question isn't as important as the question, what kind of ice cream do you want right now?
Are you going to answer the question, by the way, why we all say we all scream for ice cream?
No, I just said, have you ever wondered? Because it's an old saying. And here's the thing that I feel like, and I don't want to get too nerdy and go down the history of ice cream too much, but it has played an important role in America. I'm not kidding.
No.
To impress people, and early in our country's history, people would serve ice cream. It was a big deal. It was a delicacy, right? Because it was hard to get ice and things like that. I remember, and this is just kind of a funny thing, but my mom wrote a book about Lincoln, Nebraska, where I grew up. And when they were trying to decide where to put the capital of Nebraska, you know, people were like, hey, come over here. We got some ice cream. you know, and I'm not kidding, to the committee. Like, they served ice cream to try to, like, get them. This city, this is the place that you want to have the Capitol.
Really?
Because it brings in, you know, business, and it's a kind of a big deal. Again, I can get really nerdy about the history of ice cream because it's not just a treat.
No.
It is who we are as a nation.
Now, before we go too far away for it, because
is that too?
No, that's great.
Too bold of a statement. I'm sorry. I just feel very passionately about what we're doing and who we're inviting into this conversation. I just want to set it up with the importance that it really, really has. It's not just a dessert.
It is America.
That's what I feel.
You know, I wonder, we have Tara Teaspoon on the line with us. I wonder, Tara, do you know where you scream ice cream, we all scream for ice cream comes from?
Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
You know, I'm sitting here, I just Googled it because I didn't know, and Lisa was really excited about it. It comes from a song, some random Barney franchise song, Hi Neighbor.
That's amazing.
It's a lyrics in a song.
Yep, from the 1920s.
And yeah. Tara, I feel like I'm so excited not only to talk about ice cream, but to talk with you. You are such a great chef, and you are such a great recipe creator. And I'm a big fan personally, so I'm having a little geek out moment here. I use your recipes a lot. And so I'm going to just get right to the heart of the matter. The best flavor of ice cream, what is it?
Oh, my goodness. That's a huge question. You just dropped that on me.
I know. I'm really sorry, but I need to know.
All right. It depends on my mood, but I cannot pass up a really good chocolate ice cream, like a rich, flavorful chocolate ice cream. I know there's so many fantastic flavors out there, but that's always a favorite.
So
how about for you?
A good chocolate, a good chocolate peanut butter ice cream.
Yeah.
I like goodies. I like finding
stuff.
Shapes and stuff in my ice cream. I'll take anything, any ice cream.
Bunnies, cups, tracks, whatever it is.
Doesn't matter, anything.
So when you must feel a lot of pressure, you know, because you have created so many recipes, of when people say, hey, what's your favorite, you know, summer recipe? But these are the kinds of questions that we're going to ask you right now.
Okay,
what are some of your favorite heatless, you know, because things are heating up across the country, that you make during the summer?
Oh, and I'm telling you, I can take up the rest of the show with this. This is such a fun topic because there is so much you can make that's sweet and delicious, and you don't have to bake it. You don't have any technical things. And first off is ice cream.
Yeah.
I have created, you know, almost 30 recipes for what you can mix into ice cream. And Richie would love this because
it's
yummy bits and fruit and cookies and all these things, donuts and
what?
You know, make ice cream your own. So you can buy store-bought or make your own chocolate or vanilla and then mix whatever you want into it. And I even have one that's a toasted buttered baguette ice cream.
What?
Yes.
Toasted buttered bits of baguette in your ice cream, and it's just this most luxurious treat. But you can add anything, right? Candy, marshmallows, chocolate bits, peanut butter and jelly swirls, all sorts of things. And that is a really fun way to spruce up your ice cream, make it your own, and have a no-bake treat for the summer.
Oh, what a great idea.
Other ones, yeah, it's so fun. Other ones, I am a fan of, who likes turning the oven on in the summer, but I love semi-homemade treats.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can buy store-bought cookies or crusts or things like that and make a dessert. I love incorporating all the summer fruit into dessert during these months and making cookie ice cream sandwiches, no-bake cheesecake, a bright lemon chiffon pie, an icebox cake, watermelon cakes and fresh fruit with sweet cream. So, I could go on forever, but those are just some fun
We'd
ideas.
Actually just love
these
you to go
ideas,
on. We're just
though.
Salivating at
okay.
what you're saying. I would be curious with ice cream, is there a different way that we make ice cream now than like the old wooden bucket with the salt that gets all over the place and never enough ice for when we're making the homemade ice cream?
Right? You run out of ice and you have ice cream soup.
Yep.
Yes and no. I mean, the concept is the same, but yes, you do not need to stick a big bucket, an electric churn outside with the ice and the salt. But that's fun if you're outside and you're on the porch and you want to do that method. But you've got your compressors, the fancy ice cream makers that sit on the counter and can churn a batch of ice cream in 30 minutes. You also have the churns that you freeze the bowl overnight, and then you add your ice cream mixture and you let it churn. And those are much more affordable, and so many people can have them in their homes. But the concept is the same. You're making a base, whether it's eggless or egg-based custard, and you're churning air into it while you're keeping it cold. And that's what creates that luxurious, like, silky, smooth mouthfeel of ice cream and the fun texture.
It's a fun activity, too, to do with kids, you know, and mm-hmm. have them choose. And so you get, you know, a sweet dessert, but also a fun activity.
Yeah.
You know, kind of right? kill some time. Yeah. When someone... is inviting you to a party, right? Like they say, hey, come over for a barbecue or come over for dinner. You know, can I bring anything? Oh, how about a dessert? I think we think about the same things, like ordinary things. When someone asks you that question and you're trying to mix it up, how can we sort of up our potluck game in the summer? What are your suggestions for those situations?
I love that. And not turn the oven on, right?
Yeah.
So we often think of brownies or sheet cakes or things when we're going to a summer barbecue, but I don't always want to turn the oven on. And I have a couple of go-tos that are always a hit. And one is my watermelon cake or melon cakes. And I take melon and serve it in a different way, and it becomes dessert instead of a side dish. And I create these really beautiful desserts without turning on the oven. And the way I do that is I sort of take the middle of that melon, and I cut the ends off, and then I have a drum shape. And I'll cut the rind off, and then I really have this circle of melon. And then I can put slices of different fruit on, pile whipped cream on the top, garnish it with nuts and fresh berries. And I have this dessert that looks like a fancy cake, but it's fresh and juicy and it's fun, and everybody loves it.
A great idea.
The other thing that I do is I am a huge fan of no-bake cheesecakes. They're creamy. They're delicious. You can put any kind of fruit on top. But I will make a no-bake cheesecake easy. Make your own crust or buy a store-bought crust. But what I like to do is make parfaits. So I put the cheesecake layered in little cups with ground-up cookies, the no-bake cheesecake mixture, and then a ton of fruit topping. And I'll stick those in the fridge. And then I have individual no-bake cheesecake desserts that I can hand out at the party, or people can come up and grab. And it's so much easier than slicing a pie or slicing a cake. I love that one.
Ooh, great idea.
No-bake has really taken TikTok by storm recently. What do you think about all that stuff?
Yeah, what's your take?
Well, it's fun, right? It's entertaining. And are you really going to sit down and make it? Maybe. There's that no-bake 3-ingredient creme brulee that I keep seeing everywhere. And I say, make it. Do it. Why not? But just know that it's not that real creme brulee, right? It doesn't have the same silkiness and depth of flavor of a traditional custard. But how fun that somebody has come up with, you know, that no-bake option. You chill it. You put it in a container. You make a little caramel sauce and pour it on top. You don't need a torch. They've sort of simplified something that we really love and made it trendy. And why not try it?
So what about this scenario? You've got you want a treat. You want it now. You want to make it and eat it in 15 minutes, like a quick one. What's your go-to?
Okay. Well, the first thing that comes to mind really is a semi-homemade, or maybe you've got some cookies that you baked the night before when the oven was on. Ice cream sandwiches. You can customize them. You can roll sprinkles on the outside. But grab your cookies, fill it with whatever's in the freezer, that favorite ice cream of yours, and you have that 2-second treat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Other things that you can put together, and maybe if you've got a little more patience, is like a whipped cream and fruit parfait. So many delicious options. And homemade whipped cream is honestly the way to go there. It takes 2 minutes to whip cream, put a little sugar in it, and then top your fresh fruit. I also love icebox cakes, where you can layer store-bought cookies, whether it's Oreos or graham crackers, with pudding or cream. let it sit in the fridge for like an hour, mm-hmm. and you have this decadent dessert. So if you've got a little more patience, it really only takes a couple of minutes to put together. The other thing is like a slushie. Maybe you have some frozen fruit in the freezer. Throw that in a blender with a little, you know, water or cream and blend it up, and you've got a creamy slushie or, you know, a fun, fresh dessert.
You know, earlier we were talking about sort of odd food combinations, and I would be curious, is there something that you put together that you enjoy that, you know, some people may turn their nose up at, but you're just like, you're turning your nose up because you don't know, something that you combine together?
Gosh, I like to keep it pretty normal, Richie, but I don't know. I think probably if you get into on my website, my, you know, 30 ice cream flavors, mm-hmm. one of them would be that sort of mixing savory things into sweet things. And you don't think it would be delicious, but it is. So, yeah, the toast in mixed into ice cream or...
Yeah, that toasted buttered baguette in ice cream has piqued my interest.
Mm-hmm. Another thing would be kind of have you seen that trend, the mustard on watermelon lately?
I just heard about it last night. I was with a group of teenage girls, and they were like, this is the big thing. We should try it. And I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. It's one of those sort of TikTok things where you put yellow mustard on watermelon, take a bite, and it's supposed to be this amazing experience.
Hmm.
Well, we don't have to go that far, but have fun to do like a pepper jelly sauce on fresh fruit or something like that, where that kind of combination of that, maybe a little heat or sweet and savory mixed together to make something wonderful. And so, yeah, if you want to eat the mustard and watermelon, try it. I would love to hear what you thought of it. But
I'm going to try it. I mean, I never thought that balsamic, like a reduction with strawberries would be so good, but it's so good.
True. Yeah, that's a common one.
So I want to be prepared, and like most people, I think, over the summer. And so I am wondering what items I should have stocked in my pantry, right, during the summer, just to be ready for those sort of last minute, people stop by, or I've got a hankering for this, so that I can make a wide variety of things. What do you have stocked in your pantry?
So pantry-wise, I'm all about, I mentioned them before, store-bought cookies, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, those chocolate wafers, Oreos, graham crackers, things like that that you can layer. You can make cookie crusts for chiffon pies, no-bake cheesecakes, or you can layer them in cups to make parfaits. I always like to have those on hand sort of in the back. They're not as delicious to eat every day, but, you know, fun to crunch into desserts. I have jars of caramels or hot fudge or other toppings that go well with those fruit desserts or ice cream desserts. And then as far as, you know, moving away from the pantry, getting to the fridge and the freezer, have that cream and whole milk to make ice cream bases or custards or puddings that are on the stovetop. Keep your sugar, keep your fruit, have fresh fruit around. But I also love frozen fruit. And then my other big tip of what to have in the freezer, when you make a smoothie in the morning, mm-hmm. and maybe you make too much, maybe there's extra, pour that into ice cube trays. Have those ice cubes. You can put them in a bag, fill a bag with these delicious frozen ice cubes, and then blend those up for a frozen treat when you're ready and need a last-minute treat.
I love
it. A great tip.
Great advice from friend of the show, Tara Teaspoon. If people want to get more of your recipes and just more of you, where can they go?
Well, I've got a cookbook called Live Life Deliciously, and it's available anywhere online and at Deseret Book in some states. And my website is TaraTeaspoon.com, and there are so many fun summer recipes on the website.
Tara, you are welcome back to talk food
and
ice cream literally whenever you like, even if you're not scheduled to be on the show.
I know.
Just call in and whatever we're doing, we'll bump
time.
It out. We'll get it in.
I love it. I love it. The next TikTok video, we're talking.
Deal.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks.
Coming up next, we're going to share all the tips and tricks to plan a successful trip to San Juan National Historic Site.
It's a special spotlight for Lisa's Adventure Club. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to The Lisa Show, where right now you can go to BYURadio.org and enter for a chance to win a family pass to the national parks. Now, you're thinking, what, the national park that's just down the road?
No,
that one, but also...
all of them. You can go to as many as you want.
In fact, we dare you to go to every single one of them. If you win, or even if you don't win,
that's a great adventure.
You can go to BYURadio.org right now to enter to win. Now, here's the deal. You can just enter to win one time, mm-hmm. Sure. You can also give us like your social, if you post on your social media, boom, that gets you other entries, not your social security number, which is the number that it looked like you were like, what is he saying there?
Don't say social. Social media.
If you share it, you get those kind of things. And there is a special code keyword.
Mm-hmm.
The word is rocks. There is a place for you to enter it there. That gets you extra entries as well. You can't win when we give this away tomorrow. If you haven't entered, go to BYURadio.org right now.
Now, today for Lisa's Adventure Club, we're heading all the way to Puerto Rico to visit the San Juan National Historic Site. And for those who aren't familiar with this site, it's known for protecting and interpreting colonial area forts. And today we're speaking with Mike Gillespie. He is the president of Friends of San Juan National Historic Site nonprofit. And he's joining our conversation to guide us through this beautiful historic site and give us an idea of what we might see when, not if, we go there. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, for those of us who haven't been to this site, can you please describe what we might see in all of the different places around it?
Sure. Happy to. And by the way, if you win this national park pass that you were just talking about, it applies down here in San Juan as well.
I love that.
The San Juan National Historic Site is about 500 years old. It's in the city of San Juan, Puerto Rico, as you can imagine, in the old San Juan part. And it primarily consists of two massive military fortifications. One is called El Morro, and the other one is called San Cristobal. And as well as the walls that surround old San Juan, including the gate, which would have been at the time the official entry point into Old San Juan. So it's a beautiful historic site with a tremendous amount of military architecture and, as you said, colonial historical significance.
So when you go into the San Juan Historic Site, what are the different things that you could do or see?
Sure. Well, so there are two forts. And they each have their own purpose.
Okay.
The oldest fort, El Morro, which was built and designed to protect the city from invasions against invaders that would invade from the sea. So it's orientated and the cannons are pointing to protect San Juan Harbor. And then there's a little fort on the other side of the harbor called El Cañuelo, which creates a crossfire opportunity for attacking armies or ships. So, you know, when you go to that fort, for example, if you were coming in on a cruise ship, you would go right by El Morro. And one of the most popular things for tourists mm-hmm. to do is go to El Morro first. The other fort is built and designed to protect against invaders from the land. So it's about a mile away. And it is a completely different structure, but fascinating in the engineering and the way that the fort was built and constructed to defend the city. It's just amazing, really just amazing.
One of the great things about the San Juan National Historic Site is the people that you guys have working there. When you take a tour and the way that they're able to almost take you back in time and explain with why things are the way they were or different features within the fortification. Mm-hmm. I mean, the docents, I think is what you call them, that you have working there are just so informative. It really can transfer you back in time.
It really can. They call a lot of that rich living history. So we will dress up in period uniforms and conduct exercises and blast the cannon and shoot the muskets and reenact some of the fun, I guess, if you could call war fun.
Right.
But you know what I mean. But,
yeah.
But as far as the kids go, if you bring kids to the fort, I mean, there's no better place for a kid to play than in a big fort, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
what every kid wants to play in the forts.
And do you have to sign up ahead of time for these kinds of tours? Or if you're planning a trip, what sort of preparation do you need?
Yeah, sometimes it's good to plan ahead in the sense of special tours. So, for example, we're the Friends, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview. We're a Friends group, and we facilitate special events, special tours, special programs. We have children's programs that we do. We have dungeon tours. We have tunnel tours. And so we can arrange special experiences for you that would not necessarily be available to the general public.
Hmm.
And that's what the Friends group would be doing to benefit the park. We would put together a special event or a tour or program, and we would use the funds generated to support the park, basically. But there's a lot mm-hmm. that can be done, for sure.
So if you're planning a visit to this historic site and you really want to make the most of your visit, how long do you need? Do you need a day? Do you need a few days?
Yeah, I mean, you can really do a lot in one day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep in mind that historically, a lot of the people that visit are passengers on the cruise ships. And, you know, those are very tight schedules. So generally speaking, people that kind of try to get to the park, they get off the ship at, you know, say 9:30 in the morning. It's a 20-minute walk from the cruise ship to the park. So maybe from 10 to noon, you can explore El Morro and then grab a lunch in a nearby cafe. And then maybe from 1 to 2, explore San Cristobal, which is a short walk away as well. And they each have their own fascinating things to explore. So, for example, in San Cristobal, you definitely want to go to the dungeon. And the dungeon.
Okay. Don't miss the dungeon.
Don't miss the dungeon. I know it sounds morbid, and I know it sounds crazy, but, I mean, historically, it's just a treasure trove because you have graffiti on the walls and you have drawings over the past 500 years of history reflected inside the dungeon. And it's a horrible place to be, but, you know, you can experience it. And another amazing part of that fort would be the tunnel system. So the tunnels were built as part of the defensive structure. If the bad guys were coming towards your fort and they were crossing the field in front of the fort, underneath the field was tunneled and mined to expel expel the invaders. But mm-hmm. you know, those tunnels you can access through special programs, and then just from an engineering standpoint, the thought and construction mm-hmm. of the site is just magnificent.
We're talking with Mike Gillespie about the San Juan National Historic Site, particularly the two fortifications. One of the other great things about the dungeon is if you're there with kids, and you know how sometimes as parents we make these like blank threats, it's an opportunity for you to actually fulfill the threat your children have been particularly bad, either on the trip or on the cruise. Listen, this is the dungeon. I told you. I warned you. The choices that you have made are now fulfilled.
Give them a visual for your threats.
You
thought
I was
saying?
Joking, didn't you? Didn't you? Now, Mike, you mentioned it, and it is worth noting, within the fortifications, I don't believe that there is food, but around the fortifications, there are some pretty delicious things.
The cafes.
What do we need to drop in or try when we're in the San Juan area?
You need to drop in and try the local cuisine that would be, you know, fish, of course, and some of the rice dishes, which are excellent. It's very family friendly, very moderately priced. You don't need the chains. You know, you don't want to get into a sit down heavy lunch when you're cruising through the old city with your family, right? You just mm-hmm. want to grab a taco and maybe a cold beer and keep going or a refreshment. So, I mean, there are lots of things to choose from. Some of the popular dishes in Old San Juan are fish tacos, for example, with fresh fish. Mm-hmm. The rice, as I mentioned a second ago, some of the meats are really, really good. And it just kind of depends on your appetite and what you're looking to do. But you'll have no shortage of great places for lunch or snacks while you're in Old San Juan.
What is the best time of the year to visit?
You know, Lisa, traditionally the busiest time of year has been when the snow flies up north, right? So the snowbirds would head from Thanksgiving to Easter. It traditionally would be very busy.
So, but, you know, these days after the pandemic, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Right now it's June and it's crazy busy. So even though the cruise ships are not sailing yet, the hotel occupancy is very high. The flights are very inexpensive. And we just have a lot of people on the island, a lot of tourists on the island from the States right now, and have had them, you know, increasingly more since things are lightening up and loosening up with the COVID restrictions. Yeah.
For people that have never traveled to Puerto Rico, what with it being a territory, I think technically, a United States territory, are there any considerations that people need to make, you know, passport, money, anything like that as we travel to San Juan?
Yeah, and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. So Uncle Sam is here in his full bright glory with the U.S. dollar, which we love, right? So the money is important. The federal government is here. You are you do not need a passport. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, and so you can easily travel in between the states and Puerto Rico without any extra documentation, and you can travel light because the weather is very, very nice. Bring your shorts and your sunscreen and your, you know, sneakers and an umbrella. It happens to be raining right now here.
Oh, really?
It's a tropical rain, so it goes by quick. But in terms of preparation, that's really all you need to know. You're not traveling to a different country. The language is English and Spanish. Pretty much everybody that you'll be encountering is bilingual. So it's a great cultural experience.
Now, other than the dungeon, what is your favorite part of the park? Maybe a different area that we might not consider.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So going back to El Morro, which is the oldest fort, which was started in 1539, one of my favorite things to do is show the graffiti that the soldiers who were on guard, and many of them didn't read or write, but they drew pictures hundreds of years ago on the wall, right? So they had this red crayon type of a pencil crayon, and they would draw ships, sailing ships, and they would, you know, kind of just show what they were seeing from their guard post in La Garita, which is the sentry box, which is uniquely the Puerto Rican symbol, which is it's the lookout tower in English, right? So
yeah.
When you look at in Puerto Rico, you see the sentry tower or the sentry post, which is where the lookout would be. And I love going into the sentries because it just takes you into the into the history of the fort. And the kids can walk in and they can look out over the ocean and imagine that they're guarding the place.
Oh, wow.
On a broader scale, if people are planning on going to Puerto Rico, obviously they'll stop and see the San Juan National Historic Sites and see the fortifications.
Oh, yeah.
They'll eat the food in the local cafes. Are there other points of interest if we're making a week-long trip to Puerto Rico? This will be a stop. Other things that we should put on our agenda?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the National Forest, which is called El Yunque, that's a Yunque, is a magnificent forest, tropical forest, one of the few in the United States. That's worth a visit. Of course, the snorkeling and the diving and the surf sailing and, you know, the water activities are awesome. There are lots of options to do that. There are snorkeling trips you can take for the day or for the half a day and go outside of the city, go to the island. I'll tell you, as a golfer, the golfing is excellent. There's a tremendous golf industry here, some really talented players and some beautiful, beautiful courses. So certainly if you're a golfer, tennis is popular, sailing and boating. I mean, anything that you can imagine fun doing on vacation for a week, you can check them off day by day. Do a cross-island trip to the south part of the island, which is the Caribbean Sea, the north side being the Atlantic. And there's really a lot to do. It just kind of depends on your appetite.
So paradise. Cool. Yeah. All right.
I know. It sounds amazing. Yeah. Really.
Yeah. We look forward to seeing you guys down here, Lisa and Richie, and, you know, maybe do your show from down here.
Oh,
done.
That would be amazing.
We would do that in a heartbeat. Mike Gillespie, president of the Friends of the San Juan National Historic Site. It's a nonprofit organization which you can visit online by going to friendsofsjnhs.org. Mike, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Fish tacos is what I want so bad. I'd go there.
Tropical forests and going to forts and discovering different, you know, history, going back in time. To me, that's so exciting. It's when you think it's going to be one thing when you set out to go on an adventure mm-hmm. like this. And mm-hmm. this is one of the reasons why I love Lisa's Adventure Club, because it just expands your mind about what's possible, because it's an entirely different experience when you actually get there and do it.
Yeah. You want experiences? You want adventure?
Yes.
Go to BYURadio.org right now and enter to win a family annual National Parks Pass. Now, you don't have to have a family, single person. Maybe it's just you and your spouse.
A group of friends.
That's technically
I think
a family.
That would be fun.
Gal pals or bros, as we like to say.
We like
get
to say
the bros.
That. Yeah, the gals
guys.
and the bros.
Whatever the adventures are.
Yeah.
The nice thing about the annual parks pass, you can use it more than once for an entire year. You could see all the parks, make the memories.
It's almost like a dare, right? Like, okay, so you get this pass. Where can you go?
Where you're not going to go. That's
yeah.
what I say.
Oh.
Go to BYURadio.org right now and enter to win.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143.
The Lisa Show also has a podcast available wherever you get podcasts. Search The Lisa Show and listen for the keyword I forgot to tell you, which is rocks, if you want more entries for the Lisa's Adventure Club.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn how to avoid caretaker burnout.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.